Blog Talk Radio.
Over 120 years ago, freedmen became lawmen. Independent communities were built. Businesses, schools, people were thriving. Until organized destruction ensued. Fires, murder, violence, poverty, disease, all seemed lost. A community of people barely alive. Fast forward the year 2012. We can rebuild. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first conglomerate of organized, with united community. With the black community to be that force. Better than before. Better, stronger, united. Black Reconstruction. With your co-hosts, Sister LaShawn Allen Muhammad and Brother Malik Green.
LaShawn Allen Muhammad, and welcome to the Keys 107 Black Reconstruction with your host, myself, LaShawn Allen Muhammad, and Malik Green. Malik, are you on the air?
Yes, I am. How are you doing today, dear?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Very excited about the show.
Yes, 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 I am too. I want to welcome everyone who's joined us here. We're very excited. This has been a long time coming, and I just want everyone to just relax and take your pencils out, you know, because we're going to give a little history tonight. And we hope that you not only join us for tonight, but join us for the long haul, because this is a movement. This is not only a show, it's a movement about our community and how to define the strategic plan that we need to unite, become strong, and just be self-sufficient and have and thriving communities as we did in the past. So before I move on, I just want to give the listeners the call-in number. It's 213-943-3618. Again, 213-943-3618. And once we get to the question and answer segment of the show, if you would like to ask a question of myself or Brother Malik, please remember to press 1. To get into the queue, okay? So now I'd just like to introduce the audience to my wonderful co-host, Brother Malik Green. He's a world-renowned author of the book, The Black Print. This book is phenomenal, phenomenal book. And, you know, I'm going to tell a little story quickly. I worked with Malik's wife, and we happened to meet and were chatting, and I was telling her, at any chance I get to talk about history or talk about our community, I do. And we just so happened to, you know, be on the topic. And she said, oh, you know, my husband wrote a book called The Black Print. And I said, I already know what it's about. And she said, how could you know what it's about? I said, I'm telling you, I know what it's about. Call me later, we'll talk about it. But it was so funny. And, you know, I didn't know all the details. But when I finally, you know, got my hands on a copy, I was, you know, pleasantly, you know, not surprised, but present, pleasantly, you know, happy, I should say, to see that someone had taken so much time to really think about a solution-driven book, not just talking about the problems, but the solutions. So just to give everybody a little bit of history on Malik, he's also the founder and president of a nonprofit organization called Going Beyond the Dream. And if anyone, you know, kind of thinks a little bit about what that might mean, that is actually, let me not go into that. I'll let you do that, Malik.
Thank you. But before I even talk any more about myself, I'd like to let people know also about you, darling, because you're a fantastic, wonderful lady. And let's let them know a little bit about you. First of all, you are a married woman with four children, and that's a full plate right there, but that's not nothing compared to what you do. You're also a director of training at the for the Nurse Scholarship Program. You're also the CEO of Entrepreneurs of New York, which is a virtual entrepreneurial service agency for people that want to start business and learn to network and get some of the skills, develop their skills for business. This will be a great place, and she's running this program, and it's a wonderful program, an opportunity, I would say. And she's also a community activist in her hometown of Brownsville, New York. So, no, this is a tireless woman who works hard, and I've known her for over a year now, maybe going on two. And, I mean, she's into so many things, and her energy is unlimited. So I'm happy to be working with LaShawn, and she's a fantastic young lady. And I think between the two of us, we're bringing some energy and some insight, and hopefully with you, the audience, we're going to come together with some solutions to tackle the biggest problem in this country as far as African Americans are concerned, and that's prosperity, that's unity, that's love, that's togetherness. And that's something we're going to talk about on this show, and we're going to get your guys' feedback out there, and hopefully together we can start finding solutions and putting those solutions to work for the better of our people and our communities.
That's right. And, you know, Malik, what I want to also do is just quote a little bit from your dedication section of your book, and you say that you would want to dedicate the book to the descendants of African slaves whose heroic efforts and sacrifices, past and present, have enabled African Americans to sustain our quest for unity. So I want to highlight that it's a quest, meaning that this is something that's still unattained. Okay,
oh,
so that's a key component to why we're doing this. Quest for unity, justice, equality, and most of all, economic and political influence. So with that, we're going to get started with the interview. So tonight I'm going to interview you, my co-host.
Okay.
We want to give a little, because, you know, as we discussed, it's really important to not only let the, you know, listeners to talk about, you know, various topics, but people should really have a background and understanding as to, you know, what the objective and the mission of the show is.
Most
so I think that instead of just giving a boring, this is our mission and vision, we can just, you know, kind of go through some questions, Q&A, with you and talking about your book, The Black Print, which, as I said before, gives, you know, it's solution-driven.
Yes.
So with that said, why don't you describe The Black Print, you know, and what compelled you to write the book?
Well, I'm going to have to go back a little bit, and I'll do this as quickly and briefly as I can, but I really need to go back to when I was a child, I mean 5 years old, which was somewhere around like 1962. The point I'm making here is that it's been in my soul, and I have this feeling that my ancestors just permeates through my soul. I feel like since I was a young man that this African Americans, to me, were always, since I was a young kid, and any of us know, you go back to the 50s and the 60s, you know, we were Negroes and all of those colored people and things like that. Anyway, I'm growing up in that era, and I'm seeing so many African Americans not like themselves, not love themselves, not liking to be black, wanting to be white, conquering in their hair and lightening their, bleaching their skin. And I'm like, as this young little boy, I'm like fascinated about being black. I'm so happy, and I'm wondering, why do I feel this strong sense of blackness and everyone else seems to shy away? So, I mean, I was driven at a young age to find the answers to why is African Americans in this country seem to be put on such a low pedestal, but my heart tells me something totally different. My heart tells me we are something special. We are something real. And so that was my life. And I've been through so many trials and tribulations, but through those trials and tribulations, I've gained a lot of insight and knowledge and understanding. And as that understanding came to me as I became older, I wanted to now say I am so excited of having this understanding and insight and truth that I wanted to you know, pass this along to my other African-American brothers and sisters. Because I feel that through this insight that we can find a unity, an understanding, a lovingness of one another. And so that was the whole essence behind the book. And what I said to myself when I wrote the book, I didn't want it to be a book extolling all of the negative that's going on in our community, but
that's
solutions.
Right.
So how can we change this? Because all I see throughout my time was us pleading. And when I was a kid, seeing us marching and asking for help. And I was one always of let's help ourselves. Let's do our own thing. Let's stop asking anyone. So that was the purpose of the book, was to write about what I felt was the issues that impeded our progress as a people, that held us back. But also I wanted to provide some solutions of what I thought. Now, I don't think these are the end all the solutions, but it's a starting point to where I can start the conversation of others hearing me, and then we can feed off of each other and find these solutions.
That's right. And, you know, and one of the, well, just to give a look into, you know, the future of the show, what we will be doing is identifying best practices, you know, from other communities that have achieved somewhat of, you know, a unified, you know, cohesiveness and have move forward with, you know, cooperative economics and moving in a forward direction. So we will be not only using the black print as a guide, but also other examples as well.
Exactly.
I want to say that. So also in the book, you really go in depth and you describe, the African and the and also American history, but really as it pertains to the in the context of slavery and the impact of slavery. Can you briefly just highlight a few significant facts and why it's important to know and understand this history?
Yeah, LaShawn. That was actually just a good portion of the book that is related to the history of slavery and our history here in America from the beginning. Because I'm a believer that in order to understand something, you need to see the whole picture. You need to see the whole picture. If you only see a portion of it, then you can only perceive a certain, you know, and have to guess the rest. So I felt I wanted to take our people back in a little history lesson. And I know a lot of, you know, this history is all out there, but I wanted to condense it into a little small package to where at least some of the people who haven't been exposed to the history or deny it. That's one of the big things. A lot of our younger generation, I feel, don't want to even address slavery, maybe out of shame, not wanting to deal with that, or going back and rehashing the pain and suffering that we experienced as a people. I don't know, but I just felt that without these young people understanding the history of this country and how it all began, they cannot galvanize themselves and find that unity and that togetherness, because they're operating on an individual premise as opposed to looking at it from a perspective as a people. Because one of the things I did say in my book is that African Americans, to me, would never be respected as individuals until we're respected as a people. And that's true today, because you can be rich as you want to, but when you're driving in certain communities or areas, they will treat you like a criminal, whether you're driving a Mercedes-Benz with an $800 suit. They are still going to treat a black man in this type of way. So it's a lack of respect for us as a people, not as that individual. So that individual could be all he wants, but him being perceived as something lower just by people looking at his skin color. And I just, like I said, these are the issues that I feel that we need to address as a people, because we're not that, what they say. We're not as low or insignificant. And so I felt the history of slavery was point really, really big. So let me just touch on a few things that wanted to go back with slavery. First of all, one of the things I found in my research about slavery, it wasn't a racial thing. It was economics and greed. It was based on greed. And the whole continuation and perpetuation of slavery was all about greed. It wasn't race. Race became a place, was the way they would justify slavery by identifying the African as something less than a human being. And that made other people feel it was okay to go ahead and do what they did to us as a people. So this is history we need to understand. And there was a long history of deciding, even after abolition or after slavery, you know, the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, so on, we still weren't really free, and we had no real essence of where to go and what to do as a people. And when we did get that period, which that Reconstruction period, which you are very much on top of, is where it was a period of 11 years from 1865, I think, to 1877. There was a period, yes, where we as African Americans were able, after the Civil War, we were given the freedoms to go build our communities, to become political leaders in our communities, and we did. Over 200 of us were in the Congress. Many of us were local representatives. We also had our own businesses, our own little schools and everything. And we were vibrantly trying to, you know, lift ourselves up by the bootstrap, by ourselves. But what happened was there was Jim Crow and black codes that came into play, which gave, you know, the states got their rights. And this is all going to be discussed as we move forward, because this is something you can't really explain. You know, it's such a deep history and such a complex history.
Right.
So I just want to kind of briefly, but there was so many things that gone on. So basically, we have been in a struggle from the day mm-hmm. we got here to the time we were supposedly released and been freed and up until today. And it's just been a survival. We have not thrived here in America as of yet. We have still in survival mode, and that's what needs to stop. We are too strong of a people. We're too powerful of a people. Our history is so rich that we need to recognize that. And I think through that recognition of understanding your history, understanding who you are before you came to America, which is important as well, that will, I think, provide some kind of higher self-esteem and more respect and love for your own ethnicity. And that was part of what I wanted to do when I discussed slavery and the history of American and the African in this country.
You know, one of the things that that you said that's really key and actually relevant, I don't know how many people saw the debate last night, but Governor Romney kept discussing how, you know, government, you know, he's against big government, and the state should be able to decide, and the state should be able to decide. Well, that's exactly what happened in 1877. There was this deal that was struck to take the power out of the federal government and give it to the states. And what happened when that happened, that's when the states decided to implement Jim Crow, implement the Black Codes. That was because the states were allowed to implement these laws, and the federal government took their hands off of it, you know, because before, when they was lynching and all these other things that were happening, you know, the federal government was sending the troops. They would send the men to, you know, and, you know, to address the issue, to, you know, calm things down. And now with the power being in the state's hands, they were no longer authorized, let me just say that, to do it. And this is what this is the direction Romney is talking about. You know, putting the power back into the state. So it's back to 1877, honestly.
There you go. And that part there, you know, I mean, when you talk about that 1877 compromise, and that's what they actually call it, and it was a tie basically with the presidential election. And at that time, what we look at as Democrat today and Republican then was totally different back then. Actually, we were more with the Republicans at that time.
We were Republicans, that's right.
Yes. So, but whatever, that the election went on, and there was a compromise. And one side wanted the election. So basically, the South had a candidate and the North had the candidate, and the election was so close, but there was a negotiation. And the negotiation was, okay, we'll give the North or the Republicans, the party, the election, but in exchange, you must remove those troops out of the South.
Right.
And that was the only thing that was holding back the flood of white viciousness on us. And this is how we have to look at this country. We are always being on the bottom of the priority. So they were ready to sell us out because they wanted to get this one individual in as presidency, and they sold us out. That's not the first sellout. The other sellout was when the Constitution was first written. There was wanting to there was a battle to whether have slavery being legal in the country. And so what they said was, we'll address this 20 or 30 years down the road because we want to pass this Constitution. So basically they left slavery intact legally for another, 70 to 80 years again. So we as a people need to recognize this government. And that was one of the things I had a problem with our president, Barack Obama. I love him, and I think he's a good man at heart. But when he speaks a lot about the founding fathers as if in some glowing terms, that was problematic to me because those people were the ones on the hand, or they're the ones who had their foot on our necks and wondering what the heck to do with us. They had all kinds of ways of wanting to send us back to Africa, you know, just all kinds of the ideas they were coming up with, what to do with the black man if we let him free, because they kept feeling that if we let the black man go free, he's going to one day want to come back and be vengeful toward us and get us for what we've done to him. And technically you would think any reasonable person would do that, get revenge. But African Americans, for some reason, have never, ever really held the white establishment in this country accountable for its injustices toward us. We've never done it. We kind of rolling through here, and that I don't agree with, and I think that's one of the things in this book that we're going to address, is that reparations is still should be on the table, or some kind of a compensation for the free labor, the free blood, sweat, and tears, and just the suffering that our ancestors had to endure.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the other thing, you know, going back to, you know, the question of why, you know, this happened, or why, you know, African Americans or black people, you know, appear to be, you know, docile, you know, for lack of a better term.
Right.
And I think, number one, we are the original people.
Yes.
We are the first people who were on this earth. We are spiritual. You know, it's not in our nature to be wicked and evil. That's why what's happening today is so backwards. This is not even natural for us. That's why it's so difficult, you know, to even, you know, to live through it.
Well, that's why we're the only ethnic group in this country, and I kept emphasizing that in the book, that we're the only mm-hmm. ones. Other people come here later than us. Koreans came here in flux, say, what, maybe back in the early 80s. You know, they're prosperous. Mm-hmm. The Asians or you know, so-called people from the Middle East started coming over here maybe in the 80s. They're more prosperous. What happened to us? Why is that everyone that comes over here seems to find prosperity for their communities and we don't? So obviously,
well,
to me, there must be some kind of forces that's working to hold this down, or either we are a very inferior people, and I can't buy that. I know that that's not true, so it has to be the other answer. There must be some kind of impediments or obstacles that are being put in our way that we don't see or not trying to recognize, and why we keep falling over ourselves.
Well, I mean, the thing is, too, I mean, you know, as you just said, people, other groups who come here, we didn't come here because we wanted to.
It's true, right?
You know what I mean? This was a forced immigration. We didn't come here, you know, to say, hey, we want to come and build your country. We were forced to come here. We were taken from our motherland, taken from our mothers, taken, you know, I had our original culture, language ripped from us. I mean, this was some real deep-seated, deep-rooted things and catastrophic things that have happened, and we're still feeling the remnants today. You know, so with all of that being said, how do we reconstruct? How do we rebuild? You know, because we are, you know, as you said, we are a strong people. We are resilient. We're still here.
That's true.
We're still here, but we are in survival mode, and we need to flip the script on that. You know, there's enough of us with different talents, with individual talents, and together, united, which we have never done. You know, I don't know if those who might be online and seeing the different images that's the pictures that are on the screen right now, but, you know, you see Martin Luther King, you see Barack Obama, you see Jesse Jackson. These are individuals who, you know, did a tremendous amount of work, you know, for or on behalf of our community, but they're individuals.
Yes.
When have you ever seen a whole group of people unite to address the issues of the black community? That hasn't happened yet.
No, yet.
So this
exactly.
is what Black Reconstruction in 2012 is about.
Oh, and that's why I'm excited about this show. I hope all of the listeners out there really feeling us and hearing us. And as we move forward on this show, I think we're going to get into more really in-depth topics and things that are really going to resonate and touch people, because I think that as you find, you know, truth, kind of like they say, it sets you free. And as we bring truth and enlightenment to, you know, to these topics, and have our callers actually come in and also and give us some, you know, some insight on where they're seeing, because they're experiencing this every day just like us, and they may have
that's
insight
right.
and ideas. And we're going to, just like I said, that's what we're going to try to do here with this show. Bring these solutions together, you know, tweak them and try to implement them and see what kind of progress we can make.
That's right. That's right. Well, I want to remind the listening audience again to call in. The number is 213-943-3618. And if you desire to ask a question of either myself or Malik, please remember to press the number 1.
And listen, by the way, I think we have someone, one of our call listeners actually want to make a comment. I think it's a Kimberly. We have a comment here from Kimberly. She
okay.
wants to come on and probably have an announcement. Do we have Kimberly on the line? No, I guess we didn't get no callers yet, huh? They didn't let her through?
Okay, well, we can just continue.
Okay, yeah,
we'll just continue on.
Yeah, well, you know, if they can get the callers through or they have any comments, they can certainly come in and, you know, they said she must have hung up, got disconnected. Maybe she'll call back and come back on. But anyway, let's continue on where we were going. And just touch back a little bit on the history of the slavery portion. And, you know, like I said, it's a tough subject. I know a lot of us don't like to really, like, you know, really get up on it. But it's so important to understand the dynamic of who we were and how we became mm-hmm. to this here. And I thought one of the things, like you said, we were brought here, and that was something I kind of addressed too, was that we are the only ethnic group in this country that doesn't have a direct connection to our indigenous and ancestral land. See, mm-hmm. So we're like kind of like fish out of water. So when you say how can we be this way, maybe that's what it could be, is that we're not really operating in an environment that's more conducive to the type of people that we are. Like you said, we are a loving people, a communal people. We love getting mm-hmm. together and having joy and fun and laughter. We have been turned into this vicious mindset and greed and selfish mindset because that is what America is about. And if anybody understands America, you understand it does. It's not born on any type of spiritual concept. It was born on economics. Pure and simple. Mm-hmm. So it has no history of any spirituality or lovingness and givingness and communal type of lifestyle. It's all about greed and basically it's following the old caveman thing of hunter and gatherer. This you see in this country, everyone wants to gather wealth, I mean to the massive amount, and almost every other culture you kind of find throughout this world was always communal. They lived off the land. They respected nature. They understand the spiritual aspects of nature and how they could work with one with nature, not to destroy it and rip her apart for greed and money.
LaShawn, pardon me, this is Forrest. You have Kimberly on the line. She has a comment. Kimberly, you are live. Go ahead, please.
Hi, LaShawn. This is Kimberly. How you doing? Margaret's sister.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
Good. I was just listening in. I think I missed the cue before to come in, and I didn't have a question. I just wanted to tell you congratulations on the show. I love you and your guest, your co-host today.
Thank you, Malik,
and what you're talking about. And this is and I'm kind of new to getting the information about our people and the history and all that other stuff, but I'm just loving everything that I'm hearing. And, again, I just wanted to say congratulations on the show. I wanted to really more listening, and then he put me back in the queue, and I couldn't hear, so I called back.
Well, thank you so much, Kim. Thank you so much.
Not at all.
Well, this is the beginning. This is the beginning, so
that's right.
Get your pen out.
Yeah.
Okay, I will.
Wow, yeah, thanks for calling. That's exactly what we're looking for, people that, you know, want to get more insight, want to find answers, and that's the key answers, not just say, you know, well, heck with it, it is what it is, and I'm going to just roll, you know. No, let's find truth, find answers. Like I said, that drove me since I was a young man to find answers, also on a spiritual level. I mean, it same thing. Those are my two burning desires, is to make sense of the African-American in America and then to make sense of my spirituality, my relationship and connection to God. So those are my two things that I've always had a strong desire for, and I spent much of my life searching for those answers, and I can say I have found some relief to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and that's actually a great segue into one of my next questions, because you also discuss in the book that, actually, to quote you, you say, the lack of hope leads to the development of a selfish attitude and disunity. Can you briefly summarize what that point means and just provide a couple of examples of what you mean by that?
Yeah, and that was more relevant today than at any time. I look at our young people as African Americans. I grew up on the Lower East Side of New York in the Baruch Projects. And when I grew up there, 85% of the people that lived in those projects was African American, and we really were like a village then, because the parents, we all spoke to them with respect. Hello, Mrs. Johnson. Hello, Miss Brown. So on. All the kids went to school. The parents would chastise other people's children. This was truly a village back then, and all of us, we would have our little scuffles, and we're friends the next day. It was never, I'm gonna stab you. I'm gonna, you know, shoot you up the mall. It was none of that. So what I'm trying to get at when I say about loss of hope is that we become individuals. We have no love for one another. We have no patience for one another, and we don't really understand the power of unity. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could put it on the simplest forms when you look at gangs. Why our children join gangs is because they feel hopeless. They feel lost. They feel like there's no other answer, and that the gang provides them with some kind of sustenance and some kind of so-called connectivity. And so my point is that I think our Black leaders today are not doing a significant enough of a job to galvanize and energize our young people. They're the ones that's got to carry this. We're the ones can start it up, but they got to carry it through. So my point was, how do we energize them? How do we get them back focused? Because I see that right now they feel they're lost. They have no real good education that they're being provided. So then they don't have great opportunities when they get older to live a prosperous life and have a good economic foundation in life. So they are starting to see the hopelessness. So then they start saying, well, you know, I don't give a darn anymore. I got to go for self. I got to go for me. And so it's hard to get this message of unity when they've been told by certain leaders, I'm going to take care of you, I'm going to do this for you, and we're going to come together, and nothing happens. Or they see how you allow government or other ethnic groups or the police or governments to just destroy you, like stop and frisk. I thought that was the craziest thing to allow them to do that to our young children. But we don't stand up to say, no, we're not going to tolerate, we're not going to tolerate that. You're going to arrest all of us before you arrest any one of us. But we don't do that. And I think our young children see that, and they get discouraged. So they don't care about the African history and all of that stuff. They're caring about now and surviving. So that's why I came with that disunity and disorganization and this selfish attitude, because it's brought about almost by a feeling of necessity and survival.
Pardon me, family. Well, you know, this is Forrest again. You have a question and comment from Sister Margareta. Sister Margareta, you're on.
Yes, good evening.
Hi,
how
Margareta.
Are you?
Hello.
Hi, LaShawn. How are you? Good.
I'm great.
I'm fine.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, I do have a comment. I just want to say, for one, congratulations on your show, and certainly it is very, very informative, and I am really, really pleased about what I'm hearing tonight, and certainly I am compelled to do more, you know, for a community that I don't live in anymore, you know, and I think that it is conversations like this that actually spark, you know, it starts the movement, you know, and there are other small movements around there that you may or may not hear about. But, you know, I am an executive director of a business called the Ready for Success Group, and we prepare individuals to be prepared to start businesses, to form boards, to show them how to put together a nonprofit organization so that we can have more quality programs. But I'm telling you, I'm loving what I'm hearing, because it does go deeper than that. And when we put these programs together to restore our community and build these bridges again, we got to go deep.
Yes.
We got to go deep in there. We got to go in there, you know, ready and ready to with a program that will help these young people not feel like they're hopeless, not feel like when I come out of jail I won't have credit, or I won't be able to get an apartment, so I got to go back to the projects. You understand what I'm saying? And when I get back there, I might just think about doing what I did all over again. And, you know, our young people feeling like what they're going to inherit is an apartment, because their grandmother had it and their mother had it, and then they're going to have it.
Yes,
we got to go in with short enough programs that say you are not stuck, but we are coming in love and in unity.
Well, I love what you said. That is so on point, Margareta, and I thank you so much for your input. And, you know, this is stuff that we, you know, issue that we discuss all the time, you know, but I'm so excited, you know, to be able to be on air and discussing it on a, you know, on a broader scale, and be that connection, and to be that bridge to find, and that's my mission, to find these other programs to make sure that we're all connected. And, you know, actually the disconnection was also done purposely, you know, so we have to, as you said, go deep.
Definitely. We need our children back. We must get our children back, and that starts with getting our communities back. Once we control our communities, we'll control the schools, the business, and the crime, and our children. Basically, the way I look at it is the communities are like soil, and if those communities are not enriched soil, then how do you produce great fruit? So we need to make these communities wholesome, so that our children, like little babies and little flowers, will grow healthy and with vibrancy, and not this craziness and dying before they hit 23 years old. This is sickness. This is crazy. And it burns me. It gets me. It gets my juices going when I talk about it. I'm sorry.
Malik and LaShawn, listen, we have Gina on the line. And also, we have another caller right behind Gina. And the chat room is full of people. Give a shout-out to the people in this chat room. But, Gina, you are live with Black Reconstruction. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Good evening, Ms. Muhammad and Malik.
Hey, good evening, dear.
Yeah, hello, Gina. How are you? This is my sister, Malik.
Oh, hey, how are you, dear?
Hi, Malik. Yes,
how are you?
This is your sister checking in. How are you doing tonight?
Yes.
Okay.
We're
well,
good.
First
how you doing,
Gina? I'm good. I'm good. I first would like to say that this show is very informative and necessary. And also, as Ms. Margaretta stated earlier, I also feel compelled to rebuild and reconstruct. Just listening to you two talk about history and, you know, slavery and what we used to have and, you know, what we don't have now,
right.
It does compel me to want to do more.
Thank you.
And
thank
also,
you.
Yes, you're welcome. I'm sorry. I have a question for the author, Malik.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I have two questions. The first question is, where can I get the book, The Black Prince?
It's on Amazon.com and on
okay.
Barnes & Noble. Yeah, either one. You can go on there and just type in The Black Prince, and you should be able to buy it there.
Okay, is The Black Prince or Prince?
The Black Prince, and the whole title is called The Black Prince, and then it's called, the subtitle is Black America's Blueprint for Achieving Wealth, Prosperity, and Respect. And so that was the present premise of the book, and that was the ultimate goals that we want to establish. Basically, the same thing here with this show. We need to reestablish the glory of the African.
Yes, I agree. Oh, that's beautiful. Okay, and the last thing, it's really not a question. It's more of a comment. And, Malik, you stated earlier that you believe that young people do not want to address slavery due to shame.
Yes.
And again, you said another reason. So I want to just tell you guys what I believe that it may be.
Okay.
I feel that the younger generation may feel that, you know, we have arrived and that we have already reached our plateau,
oh
you know, due
gosh.
To false senses of security. False senses of security such as a job, not necessarily a career, but a job, a car, an apartment, fashionable clothing, cell phones, et cetera. And I only say that because I was once one of them.
Okay.
That's powerful, Gina. That's powerful. And I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right. And that's why the education is so important. You know, and I had run a workshop, I remember, in Brownsville, you know, not only, you know, to the larger listening audience, I was born and raised in the Brownsville community in Brooklyn, which I will always feel is my home. And, you know, as an adult, I partnered with a friend of mine, and we started a nonprofit organization called the Brownsville Youth Association. And we ran, you know, employment programs. And one time I was running a workshop, and I asked, did anybody know the difference between an asset and a liability, you know? And no one knew.
Wow.
No one knew, and you know, and so it's the lack of education and the ignorance, you know, and I don't mean that in a negative way, and the ignorance, you know. So we need those of us who do know are responsible.
Mm-hmm.
We are responsible.
Yes, we are.
For making sure that everyone else that we teach and that we bring this knowledge, you know, to the masses and those who don't, and that's how you begin to build, you know, the trust, and you build the the self-esteem, you know. So,
well, can I
I'm glad
say
you
one
made
more
that
thing?
Comment.
Yes, I just want to say one more thing, and then I'm going to go. And when I say I was once one of them, I'm no longer one of them because of you, my sister. I want to let you know that.
Oh,
and I thank you.
Oh,
and
that's
I appreciate
so beautiful.
You, and I love you for that. Yes, I do. Thank you so much.
How dare you call and make me cry on my first show?
Sister LaShawn, Brother Malik, sorry, Sister Gina. We have a
question
in the chat room, and then we have about three more callers. I just want to try to get everybody in before we go to commercial break.
Certainly.
The chat room, I think they pronounce the name Palenque. Palenque. By what means we must control our communities? By what means must we control our communities?
I want to answer that, LaShawn. In my book, I had listed certain things that I thought was we needed to check out. But one of the biggest things I thought was securing the community, meaning that getting control of it, and that way would be doing eliminating the criminality and the criminal element in the community. Now, saying eliminated, that's kind of pie in the sky, but at least alleviating. And what I meant by that was that we, the men of these communities, must first and foremost come together and a consensus to say we are willing and ready to stand for our children and our women. Because until you gain security of those communities, you cannot develop a business. You cannot fix those schools. You cannot clean up those neighborhoods, because the crime element will destroy it and provide so much fear into those people that they will become stagnant. So I'm just trying to get to the point where that we must, at first and foremost, be willing as men, and some women as well, but to be willing and show those that we are willing and ready, if necessary, to die for our women and our children, and that they are, we're not going to allow you to come into these communities and shoot up our babies and destroy our communities and destroy our schools and to destroy the future of our children and a whole generation of children. So I just think that that is first and foremost. If we can do that, if we can find a way to secure our communities and have control over them, I mean, economically, politically, and as far as security, you know, and criminality element, I think that that'll give us at least a chance to allow our people in those communities to see something different and have some belief that there may be possibility of change. Because right now, they're afraid and they're scared, and these gangs have totally dominated those communities, and people are not willing and ready to come out, but we're still dying. So I just think the men of those communities need to come forward and say, but always do an organized effort, and that's what we want to do in this show. We want to provide people with ideas of how this can be done, because maybe they're not ready or sure how to do it, and they have the heart. Like this young lady came earlier and said she wants to reconstruct her community. So there may be thousands and millions of people out there, African Americans, that want to do it but are not sure how or where to get the resources or the leadership or the organization, and hopefully that's what we can bring at this show.
Also, brother, we have Brother Saladin on the line. Saladin, you're live. Go ahead and ask your question, please.
Assalamu alaikum.
Good evening, Brother Saladin. Alaikum salam, Brother Saladin. How are you?
I'm very good. Masaf here. Good brother. I grew up in, I live in New York City. I grew up in Bed-Stuy, which is right next to Brownsville, pretty much about the same age as Mike Tyson. I know you must be familiar with, you know, Masjid Attaqwa and Imam Siraj Wahaj, and just as the brother was saying, you know, we had come together in that area in Bedford-Stuyvesant and pretty much drove the drug dealers out of the community. Masjid Al-Khalifa under the Bilalians, you know, Wabi Muhammad. And so, yeah, it's fraternal order of the males. When we come together, you know, there's really a very powerful synergism that's realized. So,
yes, sir,
you know,
my brother, yes, sir.
Yes, sir, brother, you know, so that's something that we need to do, and also mentoring our children. I just want to share with you an anecdote really quickly. And again, I thank you for all your initiatives and all the things you do in the community. Alhamdulillah, you know, that I was talking to some young people, and I'm 50 years old, and, you know, I've been to college, I've been in the military 6 years, so I have some life experience. Trying to engage some of the young people, when you talk about the ignorance, you know, they have this enemy, this normlessness. I was talking to one of the talk shows on BTR, and there were three young, like two black females, one black male. When I was sharing with them, it seems that, as you said, the level of ignorance and detachment, as some people call the generation gap, but detachment, so they lack a sense of how to engage authority figures. They seem to lack an understanding of interpersonal dynamics, are very poor, and it can be frustrating. So I have to be interact with the youth on a certain level, understanding their limitations, because if you don't, I've met other people who become very jaded. Those of us who, I'm also a member of another fraternal order, who try to reach out to the community, and they get frustrated because, you know, a lot of these young people, you know, as you said, without, you know, leveling it's not an epithet, and it's not necessarily derogating them, but we're dealing with some very deep-seated ignorance and dysfunction.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And it's going to take power to change that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so, as you said, I try just even to protect myself. It's disheartening when you're sharing something very positive with a young person. I was trying to, and these were young people, and they were talking about their dysfunction. But as far as they were concerned, my age being 50, the fact that I have several college degrees, been in the military, was completely irrelevant to them. They were adamant about the effects of their position. You can't deal with somebody like that unless they have, on their own, have a series of epiphanies whereby they can gain some insight and meet you halfway. So, the only alternative that we can achieve is to create, like you said, a lightning rod of people who are, you know, they say, you know, when a student is ready, the teacher will appear. And that's all we can do. But as the brother said, when it comes to crime, we put the kibosh on that. You know, that's out. That's down. Everything else is negotiable. Right, brother?
Yeah. Hey, can I ask you a question? Now, this scenario, when did this happen when you said that they could ran the drug dealers out?
Oh, this is about in the 80s and the
90s. Right, right. Okay, no, I remember now. I remember. That's why I got that. And I know that it's possible. And it got to the point, you know, they didn't need no cops. These people knew what they were going to go up against. So they just moved to another area to sell their drugs. It's as simple as that. That was as simple as that, because what they knew was that, just like a bully is going to say, I'm not going to fight somebody that I know is going to fight me back. He always want to go to the weak ones. So if we just be weak and let them come in there and rip up the community, they're going to continue to do so. Pleading with them to stop is not going to, it's not going to get them to stop. You make them stop, and that's what we must do in our communities if we want to save our children and our women and our communities.
And, you know, don't forget, you know, Malik, you know, these are our children, too.
Exactly.
You know, these same drug dealers, these same gang members, they live in these same communities. You know?
That's why, so Sean, I was saying that if we can come in there and show them, I believe they would follow. But some of them are following gangs out of fear. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If they knew there was another force or another entity in there that controlled the authority or what goes on in that community, then they may not be so having so much allegiance to a gang and feel well, there is another alternative to happiness and prosperity. And I don't have to sign a gang. But when you don't give them no other alternative but tell them to go to school and the schools don't teach you anything and you come out of there, you're barely able to go to college or you can't because you don't have the money, so you go work for me. I mean, come on. They don't see any beautiful future and they don't see their own kind laying out their themselves for them. We knew King laid himself out on the line for us. We understood that, and that's why we gave him everything we could, and what he asked for us to come out, stand strong, and be there. Today, it's hard to get people to come out. I mean, I see people lined up for Michael Jackson's funeral. You know, they had the Apollo lining up around the corner, but if you tell them to come out because we need to stand up and stop the crime, you get only 20 people come out there.
Right.
So,
right.
Like I said, it's got to be a reason.
Sister LaShawn, I hate to cut you off. You have a lot of callers who have comments and questions. You have stimulated the airwaves. The vibration is hot. And Teresa, you're on the line with Black Construction. Teresa, go ahead, please.
Hi, LaShawn.
Hi, Teresa. How are you?
I am just so thrilled with this show and what I'm hearing. I guess for those who don't know you who are just tuning in, I've worked with you for the last 9 years. Student by student, empowering them to change their lives, their families, their communities. And you live this 24/7. I know that. But
aww.
I just think it's great. And the things that I'm hearing and, you know, I'm listening about the neighborhoods, and I think it's so important for those who are successful to stay there in that neighborhood and help create more positive outcomes for the folks who are still there. And they're good examples, but it's done one person at a time. And I think that's something to embrace. And it's, you know, some of the neighborhoods have become so wonderful. I mean, when you look at some of the metamorphosis in Harlem and how it's just really, actually, I can't afford to live in Harlem. But, I mean, some of the, where people have actually taken back the neighborhoods, it's wonderful. But I know how much a part of that you are. And I just want to tell you guys, congratulations on the show. It's like I'm really enjoying it. I rushed home just so I could put it on the computer.
Oh, great.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
Well, we need to make sure
Thank you, Teresa.
LaShawn, we make our callers know, those who cannot make it, that the shows are archived and that they can pass to their friends and let their friends go back and listen to the shows later on. They certainly can do that.
Well, maybe we'll have to share this with the students tomorrow.
That would be lovely.
It really is, because
Thank you.
Believe it or not, I mean, the impact you have on our students, and they need to also carry the message back home to the neighborhoods, because we serve people with many, many issues, but you know something, we see them grow every day and really take charge of their lives, and it's just probably one of the most gratifying experiences anyone could ever have. So, but congratulations on the show, and Brother Malik, I'm really enjoying this, so... Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
Thank you, Teresa.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Do we have, we're up against a break today or not?
I don't think we're getting a break today, Malik.
Okay.
I think this
I'm good with it.
I think
it.
This is an indication of where we're going.
Okay.
Is there another caller waiting in queue?
maybe not. Well, let's go on to where we were going. I think we had another area that we wanted to discuss with our call. But I'll listen to
But family, before y'all move on, you got four callers.
Yes.
They've been holding on patiently for like a half an hour.
Oh, bring them on then.
Can, we try to get them in there? I appreciate
please,
much.
Yes.
The next person is Cherise. Cherise, you're on live with Black Reconstruction.
Hi, LaShawn.
Hi, Cherise. How are you? This is my other sister. Hi, Cherise.
I am well. How are you?
I'm great.
Mr. Green, Mrs. Muhammad, I just wanted to say congratulations on the show. It sounds phenomenal already. I want to wish you guys much success. It's a much-needed discussion that has to be had for our children, for our children's children, for our parents, for our grandparents. Everybody needs to be in on this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we're almost doing a disservice to our children by saying that they don't want to discuss slavery or they don't want to discuss Reconstruction. I think they do, but they need to be led.
Okay.
Yes.
You know, they need a positive guide. They need role models, and they need people that are going to support them. I think we don't give them the support that they need.
And I think you're 100% right, and that's why I felt that they became so disenchanted and kind of try to go on their own trying to find these answers as far as instead of finding them as a community, individuals are going off trying to find their own way, and that's not the way. I mean, unity, we know, is the power. The power of unity, it solves all problems. You know, it solves all. There's an old African proverb, many hands make light work. We know that.
Absolutely.
We have to come together.
Absolutely.
And if we do not, we cannot make the progress we want to make. Not as individuals. We can't. Because this country is already schemed against us. So even though as an individual, and I spoke about this in the book about the different levels. We have poor blacks, we have middle-income blacks, and we have very wealthy blacks. And each one of them, though, have a stake in this game. Because even if you're rich, and most of our rich black people, our African-Americans, are rich because of entertainment. Okay, not because we developed corporations, but because of entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that we are being paid by someone who's running that entertainment so they can take that money away. So they control our so-called rich people because they can take that money away from because they didn't gain that wealth. They was being paid that because you are selling some kind of entertainment and you're making them millions and millions of dollars, so they're willing to give you a few millions on the side. So my point is that, you know, all of us as a people, not economically do we look at ourselves, oh, I'm rich, I'm middle class, I'm poor, you know, because that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Middle class run out of the so-called ghetto to go live in a middle class neighborhood that's probably predominantly white, and then their child loses that, you know, connection to their own people. But what I say is, why can't you say land is land? Why don't you reconstruct and rebuild your community and not run from your community? And that's the kind of thing when LaShawn talked about Black Reconstruction. I mean, I'm all the way for that. We're in locations where we can revitalize and make them brand new and wholesome again.
And let me just, I'm in my house by myself raising my hand like you guys can see me. Let me just respond to that. I am one of those people who moved out of, LaShawn and I grew up in Brownsville. I moved out of Brownsville. And I am in a predominantly white neighborhood now.
Me too, darling. I moved out to Long Island. I'm here in Long Island, and I did the same thing for the betterment of my children. But I'm not going to run away from this issue. I just did it for that.
That's the point. That's exactly the point I was going to make. I don't have children, but I still feel a responsibility to my sister's children, to my friend's children. You know, I think we have to accept accountability.
Yes.
Even if it's not impacting us as an individual, as a whole, it's going to impact us one way or the other. I would rather for it to be in a positive way as opposed to a negative way.
Okay.
You know, we have to accept accountability and stop turning our back on each other as a community. We have to stop doing that.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
Well, thank you so much, Cherise. That was right on point.
All right, so family, we have the great hip-hop educator, Brother Shango Blake, on the line. Go ahead, Brother Shango. You are live on the air with Black Reconstruction.
Peace to
Brother
LaShawn.
Shango. Peace and blessings.
How are you? And to Brother Malik, I'm listening to your wonderful subject, Black Reconstruction, and I love it because it's solution-oriented.
Yes, sir.
And I just want to encourage you guys to continue to do the wonderful work that you're doing, because, you know, everything starts, you know, in an infancy stage. It starts small and then it develops and grows.
Awesome.
And I think this has potential, endless potential of growth. The one thing that I wanted to comment on.
Uh-huh.
Yes, ma'am. The one thing I wanted to comment on was an earlier caller had called, and I think that he had used the term when he was referring to our young people in terms of ignorance. He used the term animal, and I want to say that we have to be careful about that. As a person who's worked in education for many years, yes, our children will show us an ignorant side, but we have to remember that our children were not born in a vacuum. They come from a set of conditions and a set of experiences that predate them. And so if we really want to look at who's at fault, we have to do some introspection. And I find that when you really are consistent in your approach in terms of reaching out to young people, you can tap into that beautiful creative side of them and bring out something wonderful. So we have to be careful because there's a trend going on right now with educators, black educators, and let me say this about black educators who are coming into the school system void of their own history. They're going to school, they're getting master's degrees, and they don't even know they don't even know black history, let alone the struggle of black history as it relates to education. They don't even know Brownsville versus the Board of Ed.
Wow.
Okay? They don't know these kind of basic things that led to them actually going into public education and providing a service. And they're coming into the school system treating their job as if it is working at McDonald's. And they now, if you close your eyes, you would think that you're listening to Europeans because they are referring to our children as animals. And when you do that, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's a disconnection. And then the students look at them and say, well, you're not giving me anything that's going to grow me anyway, so why bother?
I hear you, brother. That's 100%. That is 100%. We cannot leave them hanging or disconnect from them and saying, oh, you're this, and so we're moving on. No, they are our family too. Well, that's why I kept emphasizing that we have to come into those communities and secure them, because then once we can take that criminal element out, they can breathe. They can feel like, okay, I can be me and not have to put on this front or be this type of individual in order to survive in the community that I live in. And that's where we can give them that chance to exhale by taking that criminal element out and not making that like even an option, because right now it seems like that's their best option, and that's why many of them go that route. And like you said, if they feel disenfranchised or disenchanted that there's no one out there really giving 2 cents for them and just putting them through the motions, they're not going to give anything back, and they're going to shut you out basically and keep doing what they're doing.
Absolutely. Well, thank you
again. Thank you so much, Brother Sean.
I just want to say, you know, keep it going, keep it going, keep it going.
All right. You keep coming back.
Thank you. Yes, my brother.
This has been a very exciting show, LaShawn.
Yeah, I tell you, you know, I mean, it's just amazing. It's just so amazing, and I'm almost speechless,
well,
but I'm not.
Well, let's give them a little bit of understanding about where we're going, like starting the next week and further as we're moving forward. We're going to be starting to tackle certain issues. We're going to bring certain community leaders who are actually implementing certain programs in their community that's making some progress. And we'll be discussing of all the new ways that we can tweak and make better certain things. But like I said, we're going to tap on all of those, and these conversations are going to get even more intense and more enlightening and more insightful. And hopefully we gain more of a bigger audience and we start really, like I said, making some progress.
I'm sorry to cut y'all off again, but you have Yvette live via internet, and she has a question and a comment. Yvette, please welcome to Black Reconstruction.
Hi, thank you.
Welcome, Yvette.
Hi, LaShawn. Yeah, it came through, and I saw it, and I had to join you guys tonight, and I actually asked my husband to join. I'm originally from Virginia, born and raised, but my husband's from Brooklyn, and
really,
yeah, he's from Brooklyn, and that's the one thing. And we're on Skype, and I'm not with him, but I told him to jump in and join. And I told him, I said, "Wow, you New Yorkers stick together." I said, "I never thought from being down south that you have such rich history, you know, in New York." And that's the one thing. And he said, he just responded to me. He said, "You didn't know." So I just wanted to, you know, I wanted to jump in because I guess I never understood, you know, my husband's history, coming from New York and coming from the streets of New York and then moving upstate New York, because I knew he was very cultural. And I knew that he escaped a lot of hardships and different things. And he said that he put himself in a place, he left and went upstate New York to better himself. But the one thing he did, he carried his roots with him, and he, you know, and we share them, you know, periodically even now. But the one thing that I wanted to say that I've learned, and I listened to the guy just a minute ago, is about education, and I do promote higher education every day. I went back to school, and I'm in grad school for professional counseling. All of that sounds good. The accolades are great. But every day when I meet somebody and I ask them, hey, you want to go back to school, and they tell me, oh, yeah, to get my GED, it saddens me. It really, really saddens me, because I'm not talking about GED. I want to see you beyond that. You know, I'm referring to college or even an associate degree or a trade school. But when I meet someone that's, you know, 30s or even, you know, it doesn't matter what the age is, I just become, you know, very much saddened by that. And then I look at people that recidivate back into the prison system, and because of not a support system. So if anybody's listening tonight, I think the one thing that I'm taking away from this tonight is that you have to meet people where they are. Because if I come to people with my paperwork telling you I've got this degree, you know, criminal justice, then I've got this degree and I've got that degree, people don't want to hear that when they're hurting.
Right.
People don't want to hear that when they're broken. They want to hear that. They want to know, what do you have for me right now for me to get out of this situation?
Right.
You know, I don't have a job for you, but this is what I can tell you. You know, and these are the things that I'm just learning now, is that when you build a support system with people, and my husband and I mentor people daily, but when you build a support system with them, people want to know you care.
Yes.
They really do, and that's the one thing that I've learned as far as when the guy was saying earlier about the education and bettering yourself, things like that. And, you know, but you have to – knowledge is the key, and it's not always in the colleges. It's about taking what you've learned. If that person can't afford to go to – instill something into them, you know. So I just thank you. I thank you guys, and I thank God tonight for allowing me just to call in and see what's really going on.
Thank you, Yvette. Thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate that.
The support system is everything, you know.
Yes,
absolutely.
And meet them where they are. If, you know, if someone's into drugs or whatever, you may have to go there and sit and meet them where they are, because that's gonna be a first step of bringing them out. Because they have to know, I think they have to bond as a common likeness sometimes before they can see the light. So, you know, that's just one of those things. But I just want to say thank you, LaShawn, for the invitation tonight. And Malik, thank you. I've already looked up Amazon, and I've already sent that out for hopefully
some
people. Yeah, I just networked with my sister and said, please, you've got to buy this book.
Phenomenal. Thank you so much, Yvette. We'll be talking real soon.
Okay.
And actually, we need to bring you on the show to talk about what you do.
Thank you.
Very soon.
All right.
Okay.
You guys have a wonderful night. Bye bye.
You too.
All right. You too, Yvette. Okay.
Family.
Good night.
Family, we must take a quick commercial break and let the listening audience. We'll be right back. Just listen to our announcements, and we'll be right back. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
This portion of The Key was brought to us by Moon107.com. Moon107, fashions and gifts that bring out the best in you. Moon 107 is an online retail store featuring women's and men's clothing and a gift shop. The woman's shop features stylish tunics, suits, and accessories, and offers the well-dressed woman an outlet to find the perfect gift for self or for someone else. The men's shop offers classy French cuffed shirts for the well-dressed man. The gift shop offers organic skin, hair, bath accessories, and inspirational music imported from Africa, India, and Asia, as well as jewelry and accessories. Moon 107, fashions and gifts that bring out the best in you. Don't forget to visit Moon107.com.
MAUN107. this portion of The Keys was brought to you by the Entrepreneurs of New York Incorporated, a virtual entrepreneurial service agency designed to increase productivity for small businesses operating and servicing urban communities worldwide. Remember, the Entrepreneurs of New York Incorporated, ENY. You can find us on Facebook.
Keys 107, in media partnership with Harlem's newest gym, The Miss Theater, proudly presents winner, best drama at UK's One World Media Awards, and double award winner at 2012 African Movie Academy Awards, Othello Burning, a beautiful coming-of-age drama, a gripping story of South African township kids as they discover surfing, a newfound freedom. Directed by award-winning filmmaker Sarah Bletcher, Othello Burning will open shortly at the Miss Theater in Harlem, located at 46 West 116th Street. For more information, visit World Wide Web, MissHarlem.com.
Farrakhan speaks to Charlotte.
What plan does America have to create the jobs that you are seeking? She don't have a plan.
Farrakhan live in Charlotte, October 14th at 2 p.m. in the Bojangles Coliseum.
I'm clear that they're not preparing a future for us. But I'm also clear
we're going to have to provide a future for ourselves.
Get your tickets now at Ticketmaster Outlets or call 704-399-0096 now.
This portion of The Keys was brought to you by Rafika Consultants and Services, LLC. For the best consultants and services around, make sure you find us on the web, RCS, LLC.
The Keys Network is proud to welcome you back to Black Reconstruction with your co-host, Sister LaShawn. And Brother Malik.
What we're going to do right here is go back. Way back. Back in the time. Brothers and sisters.
Welcome back to Black Reconstruction with your hosts, LaShawn Allen Muhammad and Malik Green. Brother Forrest, do we still have callers on the line?
But
We have
Sonia in the chat room. She says, LaShawn, I'm very proud of you. The job you and your co-hosts are doing, doing Black Reconstruction, excellent topic. You have another comment from Adero. As a young African-American female, I can relate a lot to the issues being discussed here this evening. But I wanted to say that sometimes it's the pressure we as young Black African Americans face daily that makes it hard to escape it. And that, those are the two vital comments. I want to turn it back over, the wheels back over to you, and y'all go ahead and drive this bus. Thank you.
Okay. And LaShawn, right. Just let me tap onto that part a bit about the young lady said about the frustration. And that's something, like I said, I don't know if I expressed it that way when I was writing. And actually the last chapter of my book speaks to young people directly. But that is something that, like I said, I felt as a young man too. Like I didn't have a dad. He left before I was actually, I don't know, six months old. I don't even know his face if I saw him today. So my point is that I had to grow up in very tough situations, poor on welfare and things. So, you know, as a young person without having resources or having that support systems behind you, you're fearful about, you have apprehension about going out and reaching for the stars, you know, because you're afraid if you fall, you're done. So that's right. Where strong community, strong parenting comes in, that you know you have your dad and your mom there, and you don't fear the world because you know that they got your back, they're going to be there for you, and they're going to supply you with the resources. So my point is that these young people out here, they want us to talk to them, but talk to them in a real sense, and I think hopefully that's what we're going to do here on this show.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and just to talk a little bit about the one of the other questions I wanted to ask you is about the experience, you know, and our journey here, you know, and there's a lot of issues that we talked about, a lot of
ills, you know, in the communities. But they're, how do I phrase this? I want to go back to the politics for a brief second and why, you know, the Reconstruction period was so important, and why we had, you know, lawmen in Congress, you know, in the Senate, making laws and policies that trickle down, you know, into our communities. And go ahead.
Yeah, that was when you talk about the ills, they kind of like they're how would I say they begin from a certain point, like from one thing and then to another and another. So, like I was saying, when you talk about politics within the community, we don't necessarily have any political representation for the fact that we don't have the unity. We vote basically like, I mean, somebody mentioned it the other day in the article. I think it was Brother Alton Maddox about how we just blindly vote Democratic and vote for anybody like just there on the ticket. Like if you go into a booth and you vote for a president, there's a lot of other people down, but if you just pull the one lever, you're voting for everybody on that line without really knowing who these people are and what they're going to do for your community. And so how can we get the resources within our community if we don't address that and have political representation? But the only way you're going to get political representation is making sure that the people that you elect are really representatives and not some slick hustler that just wants to get a position and get money and power. So that's another one of the issues. And you know, when I wrote the book, I laid out certain like obstacles that I thought that was a primary obstacles, and about eight of them that we must address. And the way I said that was we must address them simultaneously and relentlessly, meaning that they have to be addressed all at the same time and with a relentlessness that, you know, we will not let it fester or ever grow. We want to kill it. So, but politics was one of those things. Crime was one of those things. One of your pet peeves is economic development. I mean, you're heavily into that, and you understand the power of economic development. That brings jobs into community. Yes. That brings revenue and money into the community so we can fix parks and build new theaters and build apartment buildings and things like that. So all of these things are all interconnected, so it's really no way to address one issue without other issues affecting that one issue. So you cannot fix education without fixing crime. You can't fix crime without fixing economic development. You know what I'm saying? So it's just hopefully when we get through the show, that's how we're going to lay out this vision as far as how best practices, how we could go about fixing our communities. It has to be a formula, and that's what we hope through this conversation with others, that we bring all these great minds together, build on, you know, from one point, and we bring all these great ideas and then bring them together and make it as a plan that we make and implement into our communities to start bringing about the results we want.
That's right. And, you know, the just going back a little bit to what you were saying about how we vote and how we, you know, select certain representatives, you know, civic education is really not, civics isn't taught in the school system. I didn't learn about the different branches of legislation until, I mean, remember, okay, let's just say this, back in the day, remember in the 70s, Schoolhouse Rock, and it had the I'm Just a Bill, do you remember that?
And it
really showed, remember that? And the cartoon showed how a bill became a law.
You know,
children are not taught that in school. You know, so again, that was, and see, this thing is all being orchestrated. But if we had, as you said, control over our children's education, then we know what needs to be taught, and we would write our own curriculum, you know, or make sure that we make sure that, or if we're not running the school, that we make sure that the curriculums that are being taught are right on point and what our children need to be, you know, the leaders of our future.
But family, my family, for cutting you off, but you have Tiffany on the line, and we're getting to that 10-minute mark before we have to end the show. So, Tiffany, please ask your question or comment.
Hello, Tiffany.
Hi, LaShawn. How are you?
Hi, Tiffany. How you doing?
I'm good. So I'm happy that I called in today because I was listening to the segment, and I heard a lot of interesting conversation going on. I'm also an educator, and I've been an educator in New York City public school system for the last 15 years. And over that time, I've had students go to Harvard, Columbia University, and other prestigious colleges and universities. And I've also had students who are incarcerated. So me, as an educator, I reflected on that and said to myself, okay, what was the difference? What did I see as an educator in the classroom? What was the difference between those students? And the common ground or let me just go back. The difference between was the parent participation in the child's education. Was the parent interest in the child's education, or and or how the parent valued education. And I hear a lot of times I hear, you know, what the, you know, what the curriculum is in the school and how it's being used. But nowadays, it's open to the community. If you come into the school and you find out about your kids and about, excuse me, about the curriculum that the school is teaching, and if you don't like it, you join the leadership team and you voice your opinion and you let the principal know, this is what, you know, why aren't we teaching our kids this? Why aren't our kids learning that? The parents have a right to go into the school system, to go into their community and let their voice be heard. But a lot of our parents do not. You know, I run a school. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. What I was going to say, not to interrupt you, but how many parents are even aware that they have that right to go into the school?
There's communication, sorry, LaShawn, there's communication via, whether it be emails, you know, if you come in, you give us your email, written correspondence that's sent to parents, correspondence that's backpacked in the children's book bags. How often do you take the time to open our child's book to read that correspondence, to know what activities or what professional developmental programs or what is at school that I can join or that I can find out about my kids' education? Or are we just getting up in the morning, sending our kids to school because we're relying on the government to educate our children instead of us being a part of that education?
Well, just to tap into where you're talking, that is an excellent point. And I think that this is why they say it takes a village to raise a child. So if we don't strengthen and reconstruct the community as a whole, because, see, we can't leave a child whose father wants to leave and abandon him, or the mother who got caught on drugs, to leave that child out there. But that's what's happening, because the community is not bringing in these children. We're not working as a community. We're working as individuals. So somebody sees one child out there, you know, he's bumming, cutting school, he's only 12 and he's quitting school, but the daddy's not around and the mother's a crackhead, well, that child is going to grow up to be a criminal or have a dysfunctional life. But if he's within a community that doesn't tolerate that, well, as a community, we're going to address this. First of all, we're going to address the child. Second of all, we're going to see what we can do for those parents to get them back on the road. We're a community. So that's why I keep saying, and the whole essence of my premise of this book was that we'd have to attack the ills in a simultaneous and relentless manner, because it's like fighting five people. If I fight one guy, well, the other four are going to be beating me up. I have to find a way to hold all five of them off at one time in order to have a chance of survival, and that's the part I'm key to getting at. I know when they say education, because we have a lot of dysfunctional parents. Well, if the parent is dysfunctional, we leave the whole premise on the parents, then that child is doomed, because that parent can't even help themselves. So, you know, we have to bring these communities together, and that's how we're going to reconstruct.
I too agree, and that's why I believe in educating the whole child. And when you educate the whole child, you educate those social and emotional ills. Everything that impacts that child, and, you know, from reaching their full potential. Everything, whether it be the mother who's, you know, a crackhead or who's not responsive, what do? You know, no, we're not going to leave that child behind. We're going to take that child and we're going to say, okay, what are the next steps? What can I do within my power to make sure this child succeeds?
There we go.
But again, you know, everyone isn't a crackhead and everyone isn't, you know, a parent that, you know, ran away for whatever reason. You know, some people, because of their lack of education, they don't value education.
Right. No,
that's the issue that we're dealing with. You know, we have to value the education. We have to instill in our children that, you know, you have to believe and trust. Because in order for you to gain information, you have to believe and trust. If my children didn't trust in me and believe in me, they would never have gained the information that I implemented in that classroom. So, you know, there are so many things as a community that we have to come together and we have to figure out a way, you know, wholeheartedly to get this done.
I agree.
That's right. And we can do it. We can do it.
Absolutely.
You know, just got to share volume of the people who called in, who's on the line, who's listening, you know, just by that sheer volume. If every person who we touch tonight touches one person, you know, there's your Cindy village right there. So that's what we are determined to do with this show, is make sure that we reach out, you know, across the globe and connect those dots and connect those all those resources so that we can, you know, really create, you know, a whole village as opposed to semi-villages, you know, around the world.
Absolutely. And I appreciate the job that you guys are doing. I appreciate this on-air conversation, and I hope it hits so many ears and that each one can teach one, because that's the only way it's going to work. And, again, I appreciate you, and LaShawn, you're doing a fabulous job.
Thank you so much, Tiffany. Thank you for calling in.
LaShawn and Malik. LaShawn Malik, we're getting near the 5-minute mark, and we have one comment and a question from Sonia in the chat room. I'm going to read a comment first. I sent an email to all my son's teachers and asked for the curriculum for the semester. Education starts in the home, and that is the reason why we need to strong communities.
Hello?
My husband is a substitute teacher and a tutorer, and many times that was the end of her statement, I guess. And then her question was to you, Brother Malik. I believe that crime is a social ill. What is your take on that?
I agree, too. But I think that, you know, we're not born criminals. We are developed or cultivated into being criminals. And so life, you know, as a necessity, is just something in all of us, is the desire to survive, is to live. And that's your first and foremost, you know, priority. And when that's all you're seeing, like that's the biggest thing on your mind, is where you're going to eat or where you're going to sleep. Well, you don't have time to think about community or school or anything else like that. And the thing is, we have to recognize our communities are under attack. Crack is not over with. Crack has left a legacy of bad parents. A lot of dads are in jail or moms are in jail. These kids are lonely. So there's an effect. And when I hear people say, well, it's parent, I hear that, but this is a new age we're living in today. This is an age where most of the time two parents work. Okay, I grew up with my mom. We were poor. We were really poor, okay? But my mom was a home mom, and my dad worked in the garment district and made pennies. But we had enough love and family and togetherness, and that community was tight, that many of us all grew up to become decent human beings. So I feel that it doesn't necessarily have to be that parent that does it. That community can do it. It's vital that, because we can't say to a child, well, you were born to a bad parent, so your life is done. And that's the part that I cannot, you know, just grasp or anything around that to say that's what we're going to leave to our children. But that's what they're seeing. And I believe that's why we're not connected with them. That's why I don't see them starting too many movements on their own. And most of them are focused on acquiring wealth, because they feel if I get enough money, I can live like Jay-Z or Michael Jordan or anything like that. So I'm just going to focus on the money. And once they get to that thing, they're lost. Because then once you lose any type of spiritual concept, you're gone as a human being.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, just to add to that, I think that the term you would hear them say is rich, not wealth, because those are two different things.
Okay.
You know? And so that instant gratification, that instant, I want to be able to buy that Range Rover, I want to be able to buy that Mercedes, or, you know, this instant gratification, is delusional. It's delusional.
Yes.
So we're here to bring the real, the reality, you know, and to educate the masses about what it is to you know, to build wealth and prosperity for the entire community, and build and then figure out the steps of how to get there realistically.
Yes, sir.
So,
and just to add one more thing before we have to go, I wanted our young people to know, because I do know that they have a desire to live well, to enjoy the best things in life. I understand that, and they see it, and they've been being bombarded with it on television every day of all the luxuries of life. So when you see all of these things, you tantalizingly want them, then, you know, like you said, you want things, and you just want them, instant gratification. What I want to teach our young people is that they can have it. This is a wealthy country. The money is there for us. We can all live lavishly and well, just like other ethnicities, but we have to go out about it in the right process, not through a criminal mindset, but through an intellectual and educational mindset, that we can compete with anybody. We can be computer designers. We can design programs. We can create car companies. We can create manufacturing companies. This is where we will gain wealth and power and then be able to provide opportunity to our children, because right now we don't have nothing to provide them, so they feel they're left on themselves to fend for themselves. And until we show them that there's a better way, they're not going to come down that path. That's what I believe. I don't know.
That's right. Brother Malik, I think you're onto something. Yes, sir.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news because, man, you have a great show going. But we're at that time where we must sign off. The computer will sign us off, and that's not a good thing.
Okay.
I want to remind folks that you're on every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Please call in. Also, if you have questions and comments that didn't get answered today, send them to the keys, THEKEYS 107 at gmail.com. The keys 107 at gmail.com. And we will forward your questions to Malik and LaShawn so they can be answered next week or be part of their subject matter for next week. Do y'all have any parting words I'd like to say to the to the audience before we sign off?
Well, first I'd like to thank you, Brother Forrest, and the producers of the Keys 107, Brother James, Brother Jason, and Sister Rafika. Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to bring Black Reconstruction to life on the Keys. First and foremost, I want to say that. And thank you all who, you know, called in tonight, who listened in, who logged on to the Internet. Thank you so much for being a part of this, you know, the beginning of this movement. And, you know, that's all I'm going to say. Just tune in next week. And tell all your friends, tell your family, you know, it's on. Put your construction hats on. You know, we're ready to work.
Malik, go ahead, brother.
I just want to say, hey, I thank the 107, the Keys 107 Network for bringing us on and giving us this opportunity, and also all of the people that came on to the show and hang on there with us. And please come back again next week because it's just going to get even more intense and more powerful, and we need you there to help us find the solutions that we need to reconstruct our communities. Thank you all for listening.
Cause I'm taking it step by step. Trouble.